It couldn't stand being trapped in one body all the time. It had wanderlust. When I came to the sunlit zone, I spied it. The lightest pink wisp of a spirit. I pursed my lips and blew, and it skittered away to the darker parts. Now for the real test. If I'd worked this out correctly, and if Jax had been right when he explained it, stepping into the sunlit zone would allow me to take control of my new body. As soon as I stepped into the circle, bright light flooded the whole dreamscape. Golden light rolling over me, filling my eyes and my skin and my blood. It blinded me. The world became a shattered diamond, an asterisk of luminous color. For a while, there was nothing. My body vanished, and I couldn't feel a thing. And then I woke up. Panic registered first. Where were my arms, my legs? Why couldn't I see? Wait. I could see. Just. But everything was washed in vivid purple, and the green of the grass was too bright for my eyes. A spasm racked my flimsy limbs. It was like brain plague, but so much worse. I was crushed, suffocated, screaming with no lips or voice. And what were these things stuck on either side of me? I tried to move, and they gave a shudder, as if I was in my death throes. Before I knew it, I'd thrown myself out of the butterfly and back into my body. I was shaking all over, gasping for air. I slid down off the rock and hit the ground on all fours. Paige? I retched. A vile acidic taste filled my mouth, but nothing came out. Never doing that again, I said. What happened? Nothing. It was so easy, but then... I unzipped my jacket, my chest heaving. I can't do it. Warden was silent. He watched as I dabbed the sweat from my brow, trying not to hyperventilate. You did do it, he said. Even though it was painful, you did it. Its wings moved. I felt like I was dying when I did that. But you did it. I leaned against the rock. How long did I last? Perhaps half a minute. Better than I expected, but still pitiful. Jackson would have cracked a rib laughing. Sorry to disappoint you, I said. Maybe I'm not as good as other dreamwalkers. His face was hard. Yes, he said, you are. But if you do not believe it, you will not achieve your full potential. He opened his hand and the butterfly flew off into the dark. Still alive. I hadn't killed it. You're angry, I said. No. Then why do you look like that? Like what? His eyes were cold. Nothing, I said. He picked up a bundle of dry wood that had been propped against the boulder. I watched as he struck two rocks together, lighting a small fire, using the wood as kindling. I turned away. Let him simmer. I wasn't there to puppeteer the fauna. We will rest here for a few hours. Warden didn't look at me. You need sleep before the next part of your test. Does that mean I passed this half? Of course you passed. You possessed the butterfly. That was all I asked of you. He watched the flames. No more. He opened the knapsack and spread out a simple black sleeping bag. Here, he said. There is something I must do. You will be safe here for a while. Are you going back to the city? Yes. I didn't have much choice but to comply, though I didn't like the thought of sleeping out here, not with this many spirits in the air. There were more of them now, and it was getting colder. I stripped off my wet boots and socks, put them out to dry beside the flames, and zipped myself into the sleeping bag. It wasn't warm, even with my jacket and gilet, but it was better than nothing. Warden tapped his fingers on his knee, staring into the darkness. His eyes were two live coals, alert for danger. I turned over and looked up at the moon. How dark the world looked. How dark and how cold. Chapter 17. The Will.
Hurry up, Pip, come on!
My cousin Finn pulled harder on my arm. I was 6 years old, and we were in the congested heart of Dublin, surrounded by shouting people.
Finn, I can keep up,
I said, but he ignored me. It was the first time ever that my cousin hadn't listened to me. We were supposed to be at the cinema that day, a crisp February morning in 2046, when the winter sun spilled white gold on the Liffey. I was staying with Aunt Sandra for the midterm break. She told Finn to look after me while she was at work, seeing as he had no classes. I'd wanted to see a film and to have lunch in Temple Bar, but Finn said we had to do something else. See the Molly Malone statue. It was important, he said. Too important to miss. A very special day.
We're going to make history, Pip,
he had said, squeezing my small, mitten-bound hand. I'd wrinkled my nose a bit when he told me. History was for school. I loved Finn. He was tall and funny and clever, and he bought me sweets when he had spare change. But I'd seen Molly hundreds of times. I knew all the words of her song off by heart, too. Everyone was singing it as we approached the statue. I looked up at all the red-faced people, half scared and half excited. Finn was shouting the song with them, and I joined in, even though I didn't understand why we were all singing. Maybe it was a street party. I held Finn's hand as he talked to his friends from Trinity College. They all wore green and waved big signs. I could read enough to work out most of the words, but there was one I didn't know. Sion. It was all over the signs. They flashed past me, high in the air, Irish and English mixed together. Down with Mayfield. Errigo bra. Dublin says no. I tugged Finn's sleeve.
Finn, what's happening?
Nothing, Paige. Be quiet for a minute.
Sion out. Sion down. Sion out of Dublin town.
We were near the statue now, jostled by the crowd. I always liked Molly. I thought she had a kind face. But she looked different today. Someone had pulled a bag over her head and a rope around her neck. Tears jerked into my eyes.
Finn, I don't like it.
Sighing out! Sighing down! Sighing out of Dublin town!
I want to go home.
Finn's girlfriend frowned down at me. Kay. I'd always liked her. She had beautiful hair, a dark auburn that shone like copper and curled like springs, and her arms were pale and freckled. Finn had given her a clatter ring, which she wore with the heart pointing towards her body. She was dressed all in black, and her cheeks were painted green and white and orange.
Finn, this could get violent, she said.
Shouldn't you take her home? When he didn't reply, she hit him.
Finn!
What?
Take Paige back to the house.
Cleary has pipe bombs in his car, for Christ's sake.
No way. I'm not missing this for the world. These bastards get in. We'll never get them out.
She's 6 years old. She shouldn't see this. Kay grabbed my hand.
I'll take her home if you won't. Your ma would be ashamed of you.
No. I want her to see it. He knelt down in front of me and pulled off his cap. His hair was tousled. Finn looked like my father, but his face was warm and open, and his eyes were blue as the summer sky. He put his hands on my shoulders.
Paige Eva, he said in a very serious voice. Do you know what's happening?
I shook my head. Bad people are coming from over the sea. They're going to lock us up in our city and never let us leave, and turn this place into a prison city like theirs. We won't be allowed to sing our songs anymore, or visit people outside Ireland. And people like you, Pip, they don't like you.
I looked into Finn's eyes, and I understood what he meant. Finn had always known that I could see things. I knew where all the ghosts of Dublin lived.
Did that make me bad? But why does Molly have a bag over her head, Finn? I said.
Because the bad people do that when they don't like other people. They put bags over their heads and ropes around their necks.
Why?
To kill them. Even little girls like you.
Now I was shaking. My eyes hurt. A bubble filled my throat. But I didn't cry. I was brave. I was brave like Finn.
Finn, Kay said. I see them.
Sighing out, sighing down.
My heart was too fast. Finn wiped my tears and put his cap on my head.
Sighing out of Dublin town.
They're coming, Paige, and we have to stop them. He grasped my shoulders.
Are you going to help me stop them?
I nodded.
Finn! God, Finn, they've got tanks!
And then my world exploded. The bad people had raised their guns and aimed their darts of fire into the crowd. I woke with the sound of guns in my ears. My skin was slick and cold, but inside I was scalding. The memory had burned through my whole body. I could still see Finn, his face tight with hatred. Finn, who used to call me Pip. I kicked off the sleeping bag. I could still hear the gunshots 13 years later. I could still see Kay, her eyes open, gripped wide in the shock of death. The blood on her shirt. One shot to the heart. That was what made Finn run towards the soldiers, leaving me behind, crouched under Molly's wheelbarrow. I screamed and screamed for him, but he never came back. I never saw him again. I didn't remember much after that. I know someone got me home. I know I sobbed for Finn until my throat hurt. And I know my father never let Aunt Sandra see me again, not until the memorial service. After that, I didn't cry. Tears couldn't bring people back. I wiped the sweat from my face with my shirt. I must still be in the grounds of Magdalen. I turned on my side, so cold I couldn't feel my feet, and curled into a ball. The fire must have gone out. It was raining, but I wasn't wet. I reached up. My fingers brushed some kind of canvas sheeting, a temporary shelter from the elements. I pulled up the hood of my jacket and inched out from under it. Warden? There was no sign of him. Or the deer. Or the fire. I'd been shivering from cold, but now my shivers worsened. Where had he gone? Surely he couldn't still be in Sheol 1. We hadn't even left Sheol 1. Magdalen and its grounds were part of the residence system. We'd only strayed about a mile from the coal spot, if that. The wind was rising. I huddled under my shelter. There was no reason for him to have left me alone. No reason whatsoever. Maybe I just hadn't been asleep for very long. I pulled on my socks and boots and double-checked the sleeping bag. To my surprise, I found a few supplies. A pair of gloves, a hypodermic needle of adrenaline, and a slim silver torch tucked into the lining, along with a manila envelope. My name was written on the front. I recognized his handwriting and tore it open. Welcome to No Man's Land. Your test is simple. Return to Sheol 1 in as little time as possible. You have no food, no water, and no map. Use your gift. Trust your instincts. And do me this honor. Survive the night. I am sure you would rather not be rescued. Good luck. I held the note for a moment, then tore it into strips. I'd show him. I'd show him right now. He was trying to scare me and I wouldn't have it. Survive the night? What was that supposed to mean? He must think I was pretty feeble if I couldn't cope with a bit of wind and rain. If I could deal with the sordid streets of Silo, I could deal with the dark forest. As for food supplies, why would I need them? It wasn't like he'd dumped me in the middle of nowhere, was it? When I looked outside the tent, I found a case marked with the symbol of cyanide, the military arm of the government. Two lines at a right angle, like gallows, with three shorter lines scored across the vertical mark. Inside the case was another note. Be careful with the dots. If they break, the acid inside will send you into cardiac arrest. Use the flare in an emergency. It will summon a squad of red jackets. Do not go south. I shone my torch at the contents of the case. A pistol with a long barrel, a flare gun, an old Zippo lighter, a hunting knife, and three pressurized silver darts. The symbols for toxicity and corrosivity were printed across the side, along with the words hydrofluoric acid, HF. A tranquilizer gun and a handful of acid darts. Why couldn't he have just given me my pistol? Well, I had to start somewhere, unless I wanted to stay in this clearing all night. I rolled up the sleeping bag, compacting it into a small sack, but left the shelter where it was. I could use it as a marker to make sure I wasn't running in circles. There was something surrounding the camp, a ring of tiny white crystals. I knelt and dipped my fingers in them, then flicked out the tip of my tongue to taste them. Salt. The camp had been made in a circle of salt. I held very still. There were rumours among voyants that salt could repel spirits. They called it halomancy, but it wasn't true. It certainly didn't stop poltergeists. Was he just trying to scare me, leaving it all over the place? With my hood pulled up and my jacket zipped to the chin, I packed my limited supplies. I put the darts and pistol in the sack, padding them with the sleeping bag, and tucked the flare gun into my waistband. The knife went into my boot, the syringe into my jacket. I pulled on the gloves. I couldn't wait to get back and face him, the scurf. I could picture him now, watching the clock, counting the minutes until I got back, sitting by his nice warm fire. I'd show him. I would not be overlooked. I was the pale dreamer, and he was going to see why. He was going to see why Jax had chosen me, because against all odds I had survived. I closed my eyes, trying to pick up an ethereal activity, but there was nothing. No dreamscapes. I was alone. When I opened my eyes, the sky caught my attention. I was lucky I'd woken when I did. The stars were about to be swallowed up by cloud, and with the sun gone, I had no other means of navigation. With no sign of Sirius, I searched for Orion's belt. I knew from Nick's passionate speeches in astronomy that wherever the belt was, north was roughly in the other direction. I also knew where it was in relation to Sheol 1. I located the three stars and turned slowly to face my path. What lay in front of me was a dense stretch of woodland, as dark as it was thick and overgrown. My heart pounded. I'd never been scared of the dark, but it would force me to rely on my sixth sense to detect any unrest, which was probably the point, to test me. I looked over my shoulder. The woodland was just as dark on the other side of the clearing. That path would lead me south, away from the colony. Do not go south. I knew his game. He was relying on me to obey, like a good human. Why should I go north, when north would lead me back to slavery, back to Warden who had put me here in the first place? I didn't need to prove myself to him. I turned to face the belt. I was going south. I was leaving this hellhole. Wind rushed through the leaves, chilling my wet skin. It was now or never. By the time I'd finished thinking about what might or might not be lurking in there, I wouldn't have the courage to move. I clenched my jaw and headed into the woods. It was black. Blind. The rain had softened the earth, leaving it spongy and damp. My feet made no sound as I trekked through the oak trees, walking quickly, sometimes breaking into a jog, using my hands to feel my way past branches. In the thin beam of my torch, I could make out a hazy mist that wreathed the tree trunks and hung in a thin blanket over the ground, obscuring my boots. There was no natural light. I prayed my torch wouldn't expire. It was scored with a Cyan symbol, probably a borrowed piece of NVD equipment. It was a small relief. Cyan-made items didn't often stop working. It occurred to me that I must be outside the normal boundaries of Sheol 1. This place was called No Man's Land for a reason. It belonged to no one. Maybe Cyan owned it. Maybe not. I had no idea where this route would lead me, but I did know that Oxford was north of London. I was heading in the right direction. My jacket and trousers were dark enough to hide me from watchful eyes, and my sixth sense was as finely tuned as ever. I could make it past any ref guards. I could scale a fence just as easily as I could slip under it. And if anyone attacked me, I could use my gift. I'd sense them in advance. But then I remembered what Lys had said about this place when I'd first arrived. Deserted countryside. We call it no man's land. That might have encouraged me, if not for what she'd said afterwards, when I'd asked if anyone had ever tried to escape via the southern route. Yes, was all she'd said. Just yes. Barefaced confirmation that there was danger on this path. Other Voyans had come this way and died. Maybe they'd been tested like this too. Was the test simply to resist the temptation to escape? I broke a sweat at the thought. Landmines, booby traps. They had them in here. I imagined cameras in the trees, watching my every move, waiting for me to step on a mine. The thought made me slow down. No, no. I had to carry on. I could get out of here. They were relying on me to think like that, to think on the safe side. I almost turned north, but determination drove me on. Against my will, I pictured Warden, David, and the overseer by the fire, clinking their glasses as they watched me run into a mine. "Well, gentlemen, here's to the Dreamwalker," the overseer would say. "The biggest idiot we ever brought to Sheol One." And what would they put on my gravestone? Would they carve in Page Mahoney, or would it just be 205940? Assuming there was enough of me left to scrape into a grave, of course. I stopped and leaned against a tree. This was insane. Why was I imagining these things? Warden couldn't stand the overseer. I squeezed my eyes shut and pictured another group. Jackson, Nick, and Eliza. They were in the Citadel, waiting for me, searching for me. If I could just get out of these woods, I could work my way back to them. After a moment, I opened my eyes and stared at what was crumpled on the ground. Bones. Human bones. A skeleton in a ragged white tunic, legs missing from the knee. I backed away, almost falling over my own feet. Something crunched underfoot. A skull. There was a bag next to the carcass. Its hand still gripped the strap. With a crunch of dry bone, I prized it free. Flies crawled on the remaining flesh. Giant, black-haired flies, swollen with dead tissue. They flew up when I snatched the bag from its dead owner. My torch gleamed on the contents. A hunk of rotten bread and a dry bottle. My skin turned cold and damp. I turned the torch to my right. A few feet away, a crater yawned among the leaves, half flooded by the rain. Shards of bone and mine casing scattered the ground. There really was a minefield. I pressed my back against the trunk of an oak. I couldn't navigate a minefield in the dark. I edged away from the tree, stepping over the skeleton. "You're fine, Paige." Legs shaking, I turned north and picked my way back along the path. I hadn't gone far from the clearing. I could make it. After moving several feet from the bones, I tripped over a root and hit the ground. I tensed rigid, my heart lurching, but no explosion followed. Resting my weight on my elbows, I dug into my jacket, took out the Zippo, and flicked it open with my thumb. A clean flame rose. A route to the ether. I wasn't an augur. Fire was no friend to me. But I could use it to perform a miniature seance. "I need a guide," I whispered. "If anyone is out there, come to the flame." For a long time there was nothing. The flame flinched and guttered. Then my sixth sense jolted to life, and a young spirit emerged from the trees. I pulled myself to my feet. "I need to reach my camp." I held the lighter out to it. "Will you guide me?" I couldn't hear it speak, but it started to move back the way I'd come. I sensed it was the spirit of the dead White Jacket, and I broke into a run. It had no reason to mislead me. The circle of salt soon came into sight. The rain blew out the lighter, but the spirit stayed close to me. I took a few minutes to compose myself. It was bitter to concede, but I had no choice but to go north. I checked my belongings were still there, then set off into the trees again, the torch in one hand and the Zippo in the other, the spirit close behind. After about half an hour of walking, the spirit trailing around my shoulders like a rope, I stopped to check that Orion's belt was behind me. I adjusted my course a little before I delved into the darkness again. My ears and nose were smarting, and my sixth sense sent tremors through my skin. I could barely feel my toes. I stopped and gripped my knees, taking deep breaths to steady my nerves. As soon as I inhaled, I smelled something. I recognized that smell. Death. My torch beam was unsteady. The stench of putrid flesh was getting stronger. I walked for another minute before I found the source. Another body. It must once have been a fox. Tufts of auburn fur, matted with dry blood, eye sockets brimful of maggots. I buried my nose and mouth in my sleeve. The smell was atrocious. Whatever had done this was out in the woods with me. "Move, Paige, move," The torch sputtered. I just started to leave when a twig snapped. Had I imagined that? No, of course I hadn't. My hearing worked fine. I could hear the blood beating at my ears. I pressed my back against a tree, trying not to breathe too loudly. A guard. A red jacket on night patrol. But then I heard heavy footsteps. Too heavy for a human. I turned off the torch, slid it into my pocket. There was no point having it in my hands. Turning it on would give away my position. The silence pressed against my ears. I couldn't see a thing, but I could hear another footstep, closer. Then the sounds of teeth working away at a carcass. Something had found the fox. Or come back for it. I cupped a hand around the lighter. My heart was doing strange things. I wasn't sure if it had sped up to a single hum, or if it just wasn't beating anymore. Behind me, the spirit shivered. The minutes ticked away. I waited. I had to move at some point, but I knew there was something in the vicinity. 3 guttural clicks. Every muscle in my body tensed. I breathed through my nose, keeping my lips clamped together. I didn't know what that sound was, but there was no way a human had made it. I'd heard the refs make some strange noises, but never such an ugly, visceral sound. A sudden wind blew the lighter out. My spirit guide fled. For a minute, cold fear stilled my fingers. Then I remembered the pistol, tucked into my pack. It would be a fool's game to shoot my stalker, but I could distract it, give myself some time to move. I thought about climbing a tree, then dismissed the idea. Trees were not my forte. I'd be better off finding a new place to hide. Still, finding higher ground seemed like a sensible idea. If I got to a safe place, I could shine my torch in this creature and see what it was. I tucked the lighter away and dug into my pack. Once the pistol was in my hand, I set about extracting a dart. Every move I made seemed noisy. Every exhalation, every rustle of my jacket. Finally, I could feel the cold, smooth cylinder of a dart against my fingers. I knew how to load an ordinary gun, but it took me a few minutes to equip the unfamiliar weapon in the dark, with clammy hands, trying my utmost not to make a sound. Once it was ready, I lifted my arms, aimed, fired. When the dart hit home, it sizzled like hot fat in a pan. The creature ran towards the source of the sound. It carried a sound of its own. A buzzing. Flies. This wasn't an animal. Nausea surged through me. I'd heard so much about the MM, but I'd never really pictured facing one of their number. Even after what I'd heard at the oration, even after the red jacket had lost his hand, I'd almost started to believe they didn't exist. Until now. It was all I could do to keep myself standing. My hands shook and my lips trembled. I couldn't breathe. Couldn't think. Could it hear my pulse? Could it smell my fear? Was it slavering over my flesh yet, or did I have to get closer before it could detect me? I loaded another dart into the gun. The buzzer sniffed at the place I'd shot. I closed my eyes and reached for the ether. Something was wrong. Very wrong. All the local spirits had fled, like they were afraid. But why would spirits fear any creature of the physical world? It wasn't as if they could die again. Whatever the cause, there was nothing to spool. I became aware that I couldn't hear the buzzer anymore. My hands were sweat slick. I could hardly grip the gun. I could be dead at any moment. Dead meat. The whole thing must have been a setup. Nashira had never wanted me to earn my colors. She just wanted me to die. Not today, I thought. Not today, Nashira. I ran out from behind the tree. My boots pounded, my heart thrashed at my chest. Where was it? Had it seen me yet? Something struck me between the shoulder blades. I was weightless for a moment, suspended in darkness. Then I hit the ground. My wrist bent back and snapped. I bit back a scream half a second too late. The gun was gone. There was no chance of finding it now. I could hear the thing. It was near me. It was on me. With my uninjured hand, I reached into my boot and found the hunting knife. I forgot about my spirit. I stabbed into soft mush. Wet ran down my wrist, buzz. Another stab, two stabs, buzz, buzz. Things kept hitting my face, small round things. I blinked them from my eyes, coughed them from my mouth. Fingers clawed at my neck, and hot breath stank against my cheek. Stab, stab, buzz. Teeth clashed near my ear. I stabbed up, back into the flesh and pulled down. The blade tore through muscle and gristle. Then it was gone. I was free. My hands were coated to the wrist in a syrupy, foul-smelling liquid. Bile surged into my throat, burning my mouth and nose. The torch lay about 10 feet away. I crawled towards it, my broken wrist cradled to my chest. I'd broken it before. It was throbbing like a bitch. I dragged myself along in one arm, holding the knife between my teeth, drenched in sour sweat. The smell of corpse wrenched at my stomach, sending painful spasms up my throat. I grabbed the torch and swung it behind me. I could see dark shapes between the trees. More footsteps. More buzzers. No. My head was pounding. My vision blurred. I don't want to die. Possessing the butterfly had weakened me much more than I'd anticipated. Run. I dug into my jacket, pulled out the syringe. My last resort. The flare gun was not a resort. I wouldn't fire. I wouldn't lose this game. Cyanide auto-inject adrenaline. Much stronger than the diluted cocktail of drugs Jax used to keep me awake. I punched the needle through my trousers straight into my thigh. Sharp pain. I cursed but kept the needle in. A spring-loaded jolt of adrenaline shot into the muscle. Cyan adrenaline was designed to wake up your whole body, not just to help it function, but to wipe out pain and make you stronger. Jillies were wired in the stuff constantly. My muscles became supple. My legs grew stronger. I launched myself off the ground and broke into a sprint. The adrenaline had no effect on my sixth sense, but it made it easier to concentrate in the ether. The buzzer had a dark, cavernous dreamscape, a black hole in the ether. I wouldn't get far if I tried to break into it. I still tried, not quite leaving my body. A black cloud engulfed me. My dreamscape darkened, and the edges of my vision clustered together. I needed to repel it. A quick-fire jump should drive it away. My spirit flew from my body, fracturing the edge of its dreamscape. The creature let out an awful scream. Its footsteps stopped. At the same time, a blinding pain shocked me back into my dreamscape. My palms hit the ground. I scrambled back up, heaving. The woods gave way to open grassland. I could see the spires of the house. The city. The city. The adrenaline surged through my veins, racing through my muscles, pushing me faster. My wrist dangled at my side as I ran like a penitent sinner towards my prison. Better a jailbird than a stiff. The buzzer screamed. Its cry echoed through every cell in my body. I vaulted over a chain-link fence and hit the ground running. There was a watchtower at the top of the house. There would be a red jacket with a gun. They could subdue the buzzer, kill it. Sweat drenched my clothes. Not far now. I couldn't feel the pain yet, but I knew I'd torn a muscle. I passed a rusted sign reading, "Use of deadly force is authorized." Good. I'd never need a deadly force more. I could see the watchtower now. I was about to scream for help, to pull out the flare gun when I found myself immobilized. Annette. It was all over me, a thick wire net. I shrieked, "No, no, kill it!" at the top of my lungs. I struggled like bait on a line. Why had they caught me? I wasn't the enemy. "Of course you are," said a voice in my head, but I wasn't listening anymore. I had to get out of this net. The buzzer was coming. It would rip me up just like it ripped up the fox. A tearing sound. A voice saying my name. "Paige, calm down, it's all right, you're safe now." But I didn't trust that voice. That was the voice I feared. I clawed my way out of the net and tried to run again. That was when someone grabbed me, threw me backwards. "Paige, concentrate, use your fear, use it." I couldn't focus. I was feral with fear. My heart was too fast, I couldn't keep up. My vision blinked in and out, My mouth was dry. Was I still standing?
Page, to your right, attack it!
I looked to my right. I couldn't see what it was, but it wasn't human. My fear reached its absolute peak. I flew into the ether, into nothing, and then into something. The last thing I saw was my body crumpling to the ground, but not through my eyes, through the eyes of a deer. Chapter 18. The Good Morrow. There are certain things in life that you never forget. Things that dig deep. Things that nest in the hadal zone. I slept like a top, waiting for my brain to block the terror of the woods. Real sleep was my salvation. The quiet interval between waking and walking. Jackson, the others had never understood it. Why I loved sleep so much. When I wanted to rest after hours in the ether, Nadine would always laugh.
"You're crazy, Mahoney," she would say.
"You've been snoring away for hours and now you want more sleep?
Not a dog's chance in the island, not for the money you're on."
Nadine Arnett, the essence of sympathy. She was the only member of the gang I didn't miss. When I came round, it was night. My wrist was clamped with a spider-like metal frame. Above me was a velvet canopy. I was in Warden's bed. Why was I in his bed? The thoughts dragged. I couldn't quite remember what had happened before this. I felt just like I had when Jackson had let me try real wine. I glanced down at my hand. The frame prevented me from moving my wrist. I wanted to get up, to get out of this bed, but I was too warm and heavy to move. Sedative, I thought. And that was fine. It was all fine. When my eyes opened again, I was more alert. I could hear a familiar voice. Warden had returned, and he had company. I crept towards the drapes and parted them. A fire roared in the hearth. Warden stood with his back to me, speaking in an unfamiliar language. The words were a low-pitched glissade, resonant as music in a hall. Standing in front of him was Terabel Sheridan. She held a chalice in one hand. She kept motioning towards the bed, towards me. Warden shook his head. What was that language? I tuned into the nearest spirits, ghosts that had once lived here. They were almost dancing to the beat of Warden and Terabel's conversation. It was exactly what happened when Nadine played the piano, or when a Julker sang a lay on the streets. Julkers, polyglots to use the proper word, could speak and understand a language known only to spirits, but Warden and Terabel weren't Julkers. Neither of them had a polyglot aura. They put their heads together, examining something. When I looked closer, I froze. My phone. Terabel turned it over in her hand, ran her thumb over the keys. The battery was long since dead. If they had my phone and the backpack, they must have the pamphlet. Were they trying to see whose numbers I had? They must suspect I knew the pamphlet's author. If they found Jackson's number, they could track him back to Seven Dials. And suddenly, Carl's vision would make sense. I had to get that phone. Terabel stowed it in her shirt. Warden said something to her. She touched her forehead to his before she exited the room, locking the heavy door behind her. Warden remained where he was for a moment, looking at the window, before his attention shifted to the bed, to me. He pulled back the drapes and sat on the edge of the covers. "How are you feeling?" he asked. "Fuck you." His eyes burned. "Better, I take it. Why does Terabel have my phone? So that Nashira does not find it. Her red jackets would be able to extract contact information for your friends in the syndicate." "I don't have friends in the syndicate." "Try not to lie to me, Paige." "I'm not lying." "Another lie." "Because you're always so truthful." I stared him out. "You left me with that thing. You left me alone in the dark with a buzzer. You knew it would be coming. You knew you would have to face an Emmite. In any case, I did warn you." "How the hell did you warn me?" "Cold spots, Paige. That's how they travel." "So you let one out?" "You were in no danger. I know you were frightened, but I needed you to possess that deer. He fixed his eyes on mine. My mouth turned dry. You did all that just so I'd be able to possess Nula. I wet my lips. You set the whole thing up when you opened the cold spot. He nodded. You released the buzzer. He nodded again. And you made me so scared, I...
Yes.
He wasn't ashamed of it. I suspected your gift was activated by strong emotions. Anger, loathing, sadness, and fear. Fear is your real trigger. By forcing you to the absolute limit of mental terror, I forced you to possess Nula, making you think she was the buzzer that had stalked you through the woods. But I would never have endangered your life.
It could have killed me.
I took certain precautions.
I repeat, you were never in any immediate danger.
That's a flam. If you think a circle of salt is a precaution, you're off the cot. I was slipping into street slang, but I didn't care.
He must have loved that, seeing me dance.
No, Paige, I am trying to help you.
Go to hell.
I already exist on a level of hell.
Exist on one that isn't near mine.
No. You and I made a deal, and I do not break deals. He held my gaze. I expect you in 10 minutes. You owe me an hour of pleasant conversation. I could have spat at him, but the line had been drawn. I left the room and went up to the second floor. I would not tell him anything more about myself. He already knew too much about my personal life, and he could discover nothing about my involvement with Jax. Nishira was already looking for the gang. If she found out I was one of his closest allies, she'd probably make me arrest him myself. I'd just pretend to be traumatized by the buzzer, pretend I could hardly talk. I could hear it again, the breath sawing its throat. I closed my eyes. The memory subsided. A thin robe hung over my filthy clothes. They smelled of sweat and death. I went through to the bathroom and tore them off. A fresh pink uniform was waiting. I scrubbed at my skin with soap and steaming water. I wanted to remove even the faintest memory of that smell. When I glanced into the mirror, I realized I was still wearing the pendant. I pulled it off. A fat lot of good it had done me. When I returned to the chamber, Warden was sitting in his favorite armchair. He gestured towards the opposite seat. Please. I sat. The chair seemed enormous.
Did you sedate me?
You had a kind of seizure after the possession. He watched me. Did you try to possess the emite? I wanted to see its dreamscape.
I see.
He reached for his goblet. A drink? I was tempted to ask for something illegal. Real wine, perhaps. But I didn't have the energy to keep pushing him.
Coffee, I said.
He tugged on a scarlet tassel. It was connected to an old-fashioned bell pull. Someone will bring it shortly, he said.
An amorotic?
Yes.
So you treat them as your butlers.
Slaves, Paige.
Let's not be delicate.
But their blood is valuable. He took a sip from his goblet. I sat with my arms crossed, waiting for him to start the conversation. The gramophone was on again. I recognized the song. I Don't Stand a Ghost of a Chance with You, the Sinatra version. It was on the Cyan blacklist simply because it had the word ghost in its title, even though it had little or nothing to do with ghosts. Oh, I had missed old Blue Eyes. Do all of the blacklisted records come to you? I asked, making a supreme effort to sound casual.
No, they go to the house.
I go there occasionally and take one or two for my gramophone.
Do you like our music?
Some. Mostly from the 20th century.
I find your language is interesting, but I dislike most modern music productions.
Blame the censor. If not for you, there wouldn't be one. He raised his goblet.
Touché.
I had to ask. What is that?
Essence of the amaranth flower, mixed with red wine.
I haven't heard of amaranth. This variety does not grow on earth. It heals most spiritual injuries. Had you taken amaranth after your encounter with the poltergeist, the wound might not have scarred so deeply. It would also heal some of the damage done to your brain, Should you use your spirit too often without life support? Well, well. A cure for my brain. Jackson would never let me sleep again if he got wind of amaranth. Why do you drink it?
Old wounds. Amaranth eases the pain. There was a brief silence.
My turn to speak.
This is yours.
I held out the pendant.
Keep it.
I don't want it.
I insist.
It may not repel the emim, but it could save your life against a poltergeist.
I placed it on the arm of the chair.
Warden glanced at it, then flicked his gaze up to catch mine. There was a light knock on the door. A boy came in, about my age, maybe older. He wore a grey tunic, and his eyes were bloodshot. Despite that, he was beautiful, like something out of a painting. His hair was a fine gold, cut around his chiseled face, and his lips and cheeks were pink as petals. Past the redness, his eyes were a clear liquid blue. I thought I could detect the shaky traces of an aura around him.
"Coffee, please, Michael," Warden said to him.
"Do you take sugar, Paige?"
"No, thank you," I said.
Michael bowed and left.
"So he's your personal slave, is he?"
Michael was a gift from the Blood Sovereign.
How romantic.
"Not particularly."
Warden glanced at the windows.
"There is little to be done with Nashira when she wants something. Or someone."
"I can imagine."
"Can you?
I know she has 5 angels."
"Yes, she does. But they are as much her weakness as her strength." He took another sip of his drink.
"The Blood Sovereign suffers under the influence of her so-called angels."
"I'm sure the angels are sorry.
They despise her."
"You don't say."
"I do."
He was clearly amused by my disdain. "We have only been speaking for 2 minutes, Paige.
Try not to waste all your sarcasm in one breath."
I wanted to kill him.
As it happened, I couldn't.
The boy returned with a pot of coffee. He placed the tray on the table with a generous plate of baked chestnuts, dusted with cinnamon. Their sweet smell made my mouth water. There was a vendor near the Blackfriars Bridge that sold them in the winter months. These ones looked even better than his, with cracked brown shells and velvety white insides. There was fruit, too. Segments of pear, glossy cherries, soft smiles of red apple. Michael made a sign, and the warden shook his head.
"Thank you, Michael. That will be all."
He bowed again before he left.
I found myself wanting to scream at him. He was so submissive.
"When you say so-called angels," I said, forcing myself to be calm, "what exactly do you mean?"
Warden paused.
"Eat," he said.
"Please."
I plucked a chestnut from the plate, still hot from the oven. It tasted like warmth and winter.
"I am sure you know what an angel is. A soul that returns to this plane to protect the person they die to save," he said. "We know of angels and archangels, and I assume the voyants of the street do too."
I nodded.
"Nashira can command a third level of angel."
"Oh?"
"She can trap certain kinds of spirits."
"So she's a binder?"
"More than merely a binder, Paige. If she chooses to kill a clairvoyant, she can not only trap its spirit, but use it. So long as that spirit is bound to her, its presence affects her aura. It is that corruption that allows her to have several gifts at once."
My coffee slopped into my lap.
"She has to kill them herself?"
"Yes.
We call them fallen angels."
He watched me.
"And they are bound to stay forever with their murderer."
I stood.
"You're evil." The cup smashed at my feet. "How do you ever expect me to talk to you, to treat you like you're human when your fiancé can do something like that? When you can look her in the face?" Did I say I had ever summoned a fallen angel myself?
"But you've killed people."
"So have you."
"That's not the point."
Warden's expression had changed. Now there was no trace of mockery. "I do not know what I can do for this world," he said. "But I will not let any harm come to you."
"I don't need you to protect me. Just get rid of me. Palm me off on someone else. I don't want to be your student anymore. I want to switch keepers.
I want to be with Thuban. Send me to Thuban. You do not want a Saga's Keeper page.
Don't tell me what I want.
You want to feel safe again. He stood, keeping the coffee table between us. You want me to treat you as Thuban and the others treat their humans, because then you would feel that you had every right to hate the Rephaim. But because I do not harm you, and because I try to understand you, you run away. I know why, of course. You do not understand my motives. You ask yourself time and time again why I want to help you, and you come to no conclusions. But that does not mean there is no conclusion, Paige. It means you have yet to discover it. I sat back into the armchair. The scalding coffee had soaked straight through my trousers. Seeing it, he said, I will find you something else. He walked to the armoire. My eyes were hot with anger. I could almost hear Jack scolding me.
You really are a silly thing.
Look at you with dewdrops in your shyness.
Raise your head, oh my lovely. What do you want?
Sympathy?
Pity?
You won't find that from him, just like you didn't find it from me. The world is an abattoir, my Molisher. Raise those barking irons now.
Let me see you give him hell.
Warden presented me with a long black tunic. I hope this fits. He handed it to me. It seems a little too large, but it should keep you warm. I nodded. Warden turned his back. I pulled the tunic over my head. He was right. It came to my knees. Done, I said. Will you sit down? Like I have a choice. I am giving you the choice. I don't know what you want me to say. Ideally, I would like you to tell me who has been so cruel to you in the past as to make you think that you can trust nobody. Warden returned to his seat. But I know you will not tell me that. You want to protect these friends of yours. I don't know what you're talking about.
Of course not.
I cracked. Fine, yes. I have Voyant friends. Doesn't every Voyant have Voyant friends? No. The London Syndicate has grown stronger over the years. The ones we capture are mostly outsiders, those that live alone, or in the streets, because they are unable to control their powers, or their families have evicted them. That is why so many of them are happy to serve us. They have been mistreated by their own kind, and while the Rephaim treat them as second-class citizens, they still give them the chance to indulge in the ether. We put them in groups, make them belong to a social structure again. He motioned to the door. Michael was a polyglot. I think your people call them Jalkas. His parents were so frightened of his locution that they tried to exorcise him. His dreamscape collapsed. After that, he could hardly speak. My voice was gone. I had heard of dreamscapes collapsing. It was what had happened to one of the boys in the gang, Zeke. That was how he became unreadable. The dreamscape would grow back with layer upon layer of armor, preventing all spiritual attack. The Red Jackets picked him up 2 years ago. He was living rough on the streets of Southwark, an unreadable with no money or food. They put him in the tower as a suspected unnatural, but I had him brought here prematurely. Though he is treated as an amaurotic, he still has an aura. I taught him how to speak again. I hope that he will find the ether one day, and that he can sing in the way he once did, with the voices of the dead. Wait, I said. You taught him? Yes.
Why?
Silence filled every crevice of the room. Warden reached for his goblet.
Who are you?
I said. He glanced up at me.
You're the blood consort of a Sarga sovereign. You've been puppeteering a government since 1859. You've supported Voyant trafficking, watched a whole system develop around it. You've helped them spread lies and hatred and fear. Why are you helping humans?
That I cannot tell you. Just as you will not tell me who your friends are, I will not tell you my ulterior motives.
Would you tell me if you found out who my friends were?
Perhaps. Have you told Michael?
A little.
Michael has great loyalty towards me, but I cannot fully trust him in his fragile mental state.
Do you think the same about me?
I know too little about you to trust you, Paige. But that does not mean you cannot earn my trust. In fact, he sat back in his chair.
The opportunity will present itself today.
What do you mean?
You will see.
Let me guess. You killed a soothsayer and stole his power, and now you think you can see my future.
I am no thief of gifts. But I do know Nishira very well. Well enough to guess her moves. I know when she likes to strike.
The grandfather clock chimed once.
Warden glanced at it.
Well, that is 1 hour, he said.
You are free to go.
Perhaps you should visit your friend, the cartomancer.
Lys is in spirit shock, I said.
He glanced up.
The red jackets chucked her cards in the fire.
My throat was tight.
I haven't seen her since.
Ask for his help.
I struggled with myself.
Ask him if he can replace her cards. He'll do it. He helped Michael.
A pity, he said.
She is a gifted performer.
I forced out the words.
Will you help her?
I have no cards. She must have her link to the ether.
He met my eyes.
Amaranth would also be necessary.
I stayed where I was, watching as he reached for a small box on the coffee table. It looked like an old-fashioned snuff box, made with mother-of-pearl and slivers of gold. In the center of the lid was the 8-petal flower, like the one in his box of vials. He flipped it open and withdrew a tiny bottle of oil, tinged with blue dye.
That's aster extract, I said.
Very good.
Why do you have it?
I use small doses of the star flower to assist Michael. It helps him remember his dreamscape.
Starflower?
It is the Rephite name for aster, a literal translation from our language. Glossolalia, or gloss.
Is that what Jilker speak?
Yes, the ancient language of the ether. Michael can no longer speak it, but he understands.
So do whisperers.
So Jilkers could eavesdrop on the Rephaim.
Interesting.
Are you planning to give him aster now?
No. I simply wish to organize my collection of requisitioned drugs, he said.
I had no idea if he was being funny or not.
Probably not.
Some of them, such as the poppy anemone, can be used to harm us. He took a single red flower from the box. Certain poisons must be kept out of human hands. His eyes were fixed on mine. We would not want them used to, say, infiltrate the house. That would put our most secret supplies in jeopardy.
Red flower. I remembered David's note. The soul method.
The soul method of killing Rephaim?
No, I said. We wouldn't want that. It was quiet in the rookery. I hadn't seen Lys since Sewell had escorted me to Maudlin. I'd had no chance to check on her, to see if she'd survived the loss of her deck. She was conscious, but not present. Her lips were pale, and her eyes wandered, unfocused. She was in the throes of spirit shock. Gillian and the bespectacled performer from the first day, Cyril, had made it their mission to look after her. They fed her, brushed her hair, treated her burnt hands, and talked to her. She just lay there, stiff and clammy, murmuring about the ether. Now she could no longer connect with it. Her natural urge was to abandon her body and join with it. It was up to us to quell that urge, to keep her with us. I swapped 2 pills for a sterno, some matches, and a tin of beans at Duckett's Jerry shop. There were no cards at his stall. They'd all been confiscated by a red jacket. Catherine, making sure Lys suffered. She was lucky Warden had prevented her from seeing me. When I returned to the shack, Gillian looked up, his eyes red with exhaustion. His pink tunic was gone, replaced by a ragged shirt and cloth trousers.
Paige, you've been gone a while.
I've been away. Explain later. I knelt beside Lys.
Is she eating?
I got her to eat a bit of skilly yesterday, but she threw it all back up.
And the burns?
Bad. We need Silverdeen. We'll try and feed her again. I stroked her damp ringlets, pinched her cheek.
Lys?
Her eyes were open, but she didn't respond. I lit the sterno. Cyril drummed his fingers on his knee.
Come on, Rymo, he said to her, irritated. You can't be off the silks for this long.
A little sympathy wouldn't go amiss, Gillian said, No time for sympathy. Sewell will be after her soon. She's supposed to be performing with me.
Haven't they found out yet?
Nell's been filling in for her. They look similar in costume, with masks, same height, same hair color. But Nell isn't as good. She falls. Cyril gazed at Liz. Rymor never falls. Gillian put the beans on the can. I found a spoon and wrapped an arm around Liz. She shook her head.
No.
You've got to eat something, Liz. Gillian gripped her cold wrist, but she didn't respond. When the beans were hot, Gillian tipped her head back. I spoon-fed her, but she could hardly swallow. Beans ran down her chin. Cyril grabbed the tin and scraped out what remained with his bare hands. I sat back on my heels and watched as Liz sank into her sheets.
This can't go on.
But we can't do anything. Gillian clenched a fist. Even if we find a deck, there's no guarantee it'll work. It'd be like giving her a new limb. She could reject it.
We have to try.
I looked towards Cyril.
Are there no other cartomancers here?
Dead.
Even if he's wrong, we can't take someone else's deck,
Gillian said very quietly.
That's worse than murder.
Then we steal from the refs, I said. Crime was my forte. I'm going to break into the house. They must have supplies in there.
You'll die, Cyril said with no hint of distress.
I survived a buzzer. I'll be fine. Gillian looked up.
You saw one?
They live in the woods. Warden left me with one of them.
Does that mean you passed your tests?
Suspicion crossed his face.
You're a red jacket.
I don't know, I thought I was, but I tugged my tunic.
This doesn't look red.
That's comforting. He paused.
What was it like?
The buzzer. Fast. Aggressive. I didn't see much of it. I looked at his new clothes.
Didn't you see one?
His smile was thin. Aluja chucked me out just for missing the curfew. Plain old Harley, I'm afraid. Cyril was shivering.
Their bite is death, he whispered.
You shouldn't go out there again.
I might not have a choice, I said.
Cyril put his head in his arms.
Jules, pass the sheet.
He did. I tucked it around Liz. She didn't stop shivering. I rubbed her icy arms, trying to warm them up. Her fingers had blistered.
Paige,
Gillian said, do you mean it? About breaking into the house. Warden said they have supplies in there.
Secret stores, things we shouldn't see.
Maybe Silverdine.
Has it occurred to you that it might be guarded?
Or that the warden might be lying?
I'll risk it. He sighed.
I doubt I can stop you.
And if you get in? I'm going to steal as much as I can. Anything I can use to defend myself. Then I'm going to leave. Whoever wants to join me is welcome. Otherwise I'll go alone. Whatever happens, I'm not going to rot here for the rest of my life.
Don't do it, Cyril said. You'll die.
Like the ones who died before. The buzzer's at them too. And they'll eat you.
Please, Cyril, enough.
Gillian didn't look away from me.
You go to the house, Paige. I'll try and rally some troops.
Troops?
Come on.
The flame played in his eyes. You're not seriously going to leave without a fight, are you? I raised my eyebrows.
A fight?
You're not going to go and pretend this didn't happen. Sion have been doing this for 2 centuries, Paige. It's not going to end.
What's to stop them dragging you back here when you reach Silo?
He had a point.
What do you suggest?
A prison break. Everyone gets out. We leave them with no voids to feed on.
There are over 200 humans here. We can't just walk out.
Besides, there are landmines in the woods. I pulled my knees up to my chin. You know what happened during Bone Season 18. I won't have all those deaths on my conscience.
They won't be on your conscience. People want to leave, Paige. They're just not brave enough. Not yet. If we can cause a big enough distraction, we can get them through the woods.
He placed a hand over my arm.
You're from the Syndicate.
From Ireland.
Don't you think it's about time we showed the refs they're not in charge? That they can't just keep on taking from us?
When I didn't answer, he squeezed my arm. Let's show them that even after 200 years, they still have something to fear. I wasn't seeing his face anymore. I was seeing Finn, on that day in Dublin, telling me to fight. Maybe you're right, I said. I know I am. His features lifted in a tired smile. How many do you think we need? Start with people who have good reason to hate the ref I am. The Harleys, the Yellow Jackets, the Amarotics, Ella and Felix and Ivy. Then work on the White Jackets. What should I tell them? Nothing yet. Just ask some questions. Work out if they'd ever try and escape. Julian looked at Cyril. No. Cyril shook his head. Behind his ruined glasses, his eyes were bright and feverish with fear. I'm not. No way, brother. They'll kill us. They're immortal. They're not immortal. I watched the sterno burn to a low flame. They can be hurt. Warden told me. He could be lying, Julian stressed. This is Nishira's fiancé we're talking about, the blood consort. Her right-hand man. Why do you trust a word he says? Because I think he's rebelled against her before. I think he's one of the scarred ones. The what? A group of refs that started the rebellion of Bone Season 18. They were tortured, scarred. Where did you hear that? From a bone grubber, 2012. You trust a bone grubber? No, but he showed me the shrine they made for the victims. And you think Warden is one of these scarred ones? He said. I nodded. You've seen the scars, I take it. No, he hides them. You think, Paige. That's not enough. Before I could reply, someone swept into the shack. I froze. The overseer.
Well, well, well.
His painted eyebrows jumped up.
It appears we have an imposter in our midst. Who has been on the silks if 19-1 has been in here this entire time?
I stood. So did Julian. She's in spirit shock, I said. I looked the overseer dead in the eye. She can't perform in this condition. The overseer knelt beside Liss, felt her forehead. She twisted away from his touch. Oh dear, oh dear. He ran his fingers through her hair. This is terrible, terrible tidings. I can't lose one, my special one. Liss began to shriek. The sounds jolted out of her in heavy, trembling spasms.
Get away! She gasped out. Get away!
Julian grabbed the overseer's shoulder and gave him a hard shove.
Don't touch her.
I stood beside him. Cyril rocked on his heels. At first the overseer looked staggered, even aghast. Then he started to laugh. He rose to his feet, clapping his hands in delight. One gloved hand reached into his jacket. Is this a glimmer of rebellion, children? Have I let two hungry wolves into my flock? With a flick of his wrist, he brought out his bullwhip, a tool designed for handling livestock. I will not allow you to corrupt one, or any of my brood. He cracked the whip towards me. You may not be a performer yet, 40, but you will be. Get back to your keeper. No.
Neither of us are going.
A fresh surge of determination crossed Julian's face.
We're not leaving, Liss.
The overseer lashed out. Julian staggered. Blood wept from a fresh wound on his cheek.
You're one of mine now, boy, and you'd better remember it.
I planted my feet shoulder-width apart. The grin flashed in my direction.
There's really no need for this, 40. I will look after one.
You can't make me leave. I'm in the keeping of Arcturus. I stood my ground. I'd pay to see you explain to him why you hit me.
I don't intend to hit you, Walker. I intend to hurt you.
The whip came hissing towards me again. Julian threw a punch at him, sending the blow awry. This was the bone grubbers all over again. This time we would win. A wildness rose inside me. I ran at the overseer. My fist hit his jaw, and his head snapped around. Julian kicked his legs out from under him. His hand loosened around the whip. I tried to grab it, but he held on. His teeth bared at me, half grin, half snarl. Julian locked an arm around his neck. I wrested the whip from his hand, raised my hand to strike, only to have the whip snatched away from me. A boot crashed into my stomach, knocking me into the wall. Sewell. I should have known. Wherever the overseer went, his superior was never too far behind. Just like on the streets. The muscle and the boss. Thought I might find you here, runt. He grabbed me by the hair. Causing trouble again, are we? I spat at him. He hit me so hard I saw stars. I don't care who your keeper is, little mongrel. The concubine doesn't frighten me. The only reason I'm not slitting your throat is because the Blood Sovereign has called for you. Bet she'd love to hear you call him concubine, Sewell, I forced out. Shall I tell her? Tell her what you like. The word of a human means less than the incoherent salivation of a dog. He hauled me over his shoulder. I struggled and screamed, but I didn't want to risk using my spirit. The overseer cut the side of his hand into Julian's head, knocking him to the ground. The last thing I saw was Julian and Liss, both at the mercy of a man I could no longer fight. Chapter 19. The Blossom. The residence of the suzerain seemed much colder and darker than it had at the oration. I was alone with Sewell, and I would probably be just as alone with Nashira. Little spasms started to run up and down my legs. Sewell did not take me to the oration room, nor to the chapel. Instead, I was dragged through the corridors and pushed into a high-ceilinged room with round-headed windows. It was lit by an iron chandelier, decked with candles and a massive fireplace. Its light played across the ceiling, casting shadows on the ribbed plaster vaulting. At the center of the room was a long dining table, and at the head of the table, seated in an upholstered red chair, was Nashira Sargas. She wore a black dress with a high collar, sculptural, geometric in design. Good evening, Forty. I didn't speak. She motioned with her hand. Sewell, you may leave us. Yes, Blood Sovereign. Sewell shoved me towards her. Until next time, he breathed in my ear. Mongrel. He stalked back through the doorway. I was left in the gloomy room, facing the woman that wanted to kill me. Sit, she said. I thought about taking the chair at the furthest end of the table, a good 12 feet away, but she indicated the one nearest to hers on her left side, the side farthest from the fireplace. I walked around and lowered myself into the chair, my head pounding with every movement. Sewell hadn't held back one bit on that last punch. Nashira didn't take her eyes off me. Green, like absinthe. I wondered whom she'd fed on tonight. You are bleeding. A serviette lay by the cutlery, clasped by a heavy gold ring. I dabbed my swollen lip with it, spotting the ivory linen with blood. I folded it, hiding the stain, and placed it on my lap. I suppose you must be frightened, Nashira said. No. I should be. I was. This woman controlled everything. It was her name that was whispered in the shadows, her command that ended lives. Her fallen angels drifted nearby, never too far from her aura. The silence grew. I didn't know whether or not to look at her. In the corner of my eye, something caught the firelight. A bell jar. It stood in the very center of the table. Beneath the glass was a wilted flower, the petals brown and shriveled, propped up by a delicate wire stand. Whatever kind of flower it had been in life, it was unrecognizable in death. I couldn't think why she would have a dead flower in the middle of her dinner table. But then, this was Nashira. She kept a lot of dead things hanging around. She noticed my interest. Some things are better off dead, she said. Don't you agree? I couldn't take my eyes off the flower, and I wasn't sure, but I thought my sixth sense trembled. Yes, I said. Nashira looked up. There were lines of plaster faces above the windows, at least 50 of them on each of the longest walls.